Hello and welcome to the GP Cast. In this edition we are going to review the action from the Australian and Malaysian Grand Prix.
As ever, I'm joined by a panel of guests, some regulars here this afternoon, or whatever time it is you're listening to this, of course. Gaz, Johnny and Juliet, so hello.
Hello.
Hello, hi. Everybody.
Right. And we've got a very special guest in the GP Cast this time around, all the way from Australia. I hope we haven't kept you up too late, Brad. Welcome to the cast.
Thank you. I'm welcome to be here. No, it's not too late at all.
Good, good. Well, Formula One, there's been a few controversies, a few talking points over the last few weeks that have sprung into action and, you know, lit up the forums and other means of communication about Formula One. You yourself, Brad, were at the Australian Grand Prix, where there was quite a little bit of controversy for Lewis Hamilton on and off the track. We won't go too much into detail, obviously, about that. Let's try and just talk about the race itself. What was the general feeling in Melbourne this year?
Well, we were on corner one for the race day. It was very cold, very wet to start off with, and very dark. But it was a good day. It's always exciting to have a wet race. It's, you know, throws it up a bit. So,
what is the general opinion over there about the FIA's decision to start the races, you know, at a later date to try and suit the European markets?
I think most people would rather it be at 2 o'clock during the day like it used to be, but I mean, it's out of your hands. So
that's true. I suppose the FIA published this weekend that they're going to have to move it back a few hours anyways, because I think it was deemed too dark and under some sort of tests.
I mean, when they mentioned that they were going to start it at 5 o'clock, I mean, in Melbourne, it's very unpredictable weather at best of times, and it's when the race would have finished, if it was cloudy like it was going to be in pretty much pitch blackness, which was. It was almost like a night race by the time we got to the podium. It was lights everywhere. It was pretty much like a night race. So, yeah, it needs to be pushed back a bit, I think.
And you yourself enjoyed a paddock walk around, didn't you, on one of the days over the weekend? How was that? Because obviously over here in the United Kingdom, we struggle to get hardly any access when it comes to Formula One. I mean, the paddock's always closed off at Silverstone every year to, you know, a small select few. So what's it like, you know, being in and about the Formula One world?
Yeah, well, I joined the McLaren membership program just to get the opportunity to get pit tours and, yeah, we got a pit tour on the Friday, and it was just before P2 actually. So, got about 45-minute tour of the McLaren garage. It was, you know, pretty good. You're not allowed to take many photos actually in there, only when you're standing in the front lane. But in the paddock itself, we walked past Degrassi, Weber. You saw Heidfeld, like all these other, you know, all these people, and yeah, it's just a pretty good experience to walk through there. So yeah, I mean, it's not for everyone. I mean, it would be good if it was, but yeah. So I recommend joining all membership programs for your favorite team. I mean, they'd probably give you that opportunity. I mean, probably in the UK might be a bit harder because there's more fans there, but for sure, if you get the chance, do it.
Sounds excellent. And you mentioned that you walked past Mark Webber. Now, obviously, being in Australia at the time and this being Mark's home race, what was the hype surrounding Webber? Was there a real belief that he could have won the race this year?
There was, actually. I mean, there was always excuses that he'd never had the car and all that, and now they're just saying, yeah, oh, he's got the car, but they don't mention he's got a very fast teammate. So, yeah, and it's not going to be easy for him, that's for sure. But, yeah, the Australian media was all over him pretty much, so, and the fans are all hoping he can do it, but yeah, I don't think he'll be better, that's for sure.
And if we move that onto the race itself, do you think that had an effect on his performance during the Grand Prix? I mean, he was very ragged.
Yeah,
and he seemed very fiery.
Yeah, I think he feels he has to perform at his home race, and he feels the pressure. The move he did on Hamilton was a bit kamikaze, that's for sure.
That's very true.
Yeah, like he said afterwards, he gave it his all, and he hoped the fans thought that he did them proud that he didn't give up. He didn't want to settle for six, whatever he was coming at the time, and he wanted a podium. So it was all or nothing, and I suppose you'd rather that
suppose you've got to go for it in Formula One, especially you know, as you say, that was his last chance at trying to win in home soil with, you know, a car that was capable of winning. But let's open it up to the rest of the cars and, you know, we'll briefly talk about the Australian Grand Prix. Obviously, there had been a lot of talk about Formula One being boring. It had been criticised throughout the Formula One world of Formula One media. But do you think the Australian Grand Prix was able to reverse opinion on Formula One? Do you think it produced an exciting race? Obviously, the weather did help.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially with Alonso being spun around at the start and have to make a charge in the back. It was great to see him and Lewis just charging through the field and overtaking cars, you know, and that's what people want to watch see. You know, want to see cars following each other closely and doing overtakes. And you just didn't get any of that in Bahrain. You know, it's excellent to see some of that in Australia.
Obviously, the major event, well, there was a couple of major events throughout the race, but the one that appears to have got the most coverage was Jenson Button's strategy call earlier on in the race to come in and change to dry tyres. Do you think that was a stroke of luck, or was it a stroke of genius from Button?
A bit of both, really, I think. But Formula One is, in order to succeed in Formula One, you have to be able to take the luck or the bad luck as it comes and succeed despite or with it. Button made a good call. He then took that good call, took the advantage that he got from it, and he performed and he won the race. So it's a bit of both, really.
He wasn't going to win it on his, if he stayed on the status quo. He needed to do something out of the ordinary. He just got passed by Hamilton, so he needed to pull something off, and doing that, I mean, it was a gamble, but it worked. So,
yeah, I think it was a good gamble. I mean, obviously, it was a good call by Jensen, and it's, you know, McLaren were very impressed by it. It seemed, you know, Whitmarsh was really emotional about it.
Whereas that was a fantastic call by Jensen Button, and ultimately paid out with victory. His teammate, on the other hand, complained about the strategy from McLaren. Do you think it was right for McLaren, or whoever did make that decision, to bring Hamilton in for a second time to change for tyres?
Well, to be fair, at the time I was thinking, as soon as he pitted him, I thought, oh yeah, great, he's going to be able to come out with fresh tyres, quickly catch up, because it wasn't a big gap, it was only like 15 seconds or so, quickly catch up with Alonso. And I just imagined him driving around Alonso, who was, you know, that by that time would be struggling with bad tyres, you know, 2 seconds down or something stupid like that. And especially when Lewis went out and just said laps like 2 or 3 seconds faster than Fernando Alonso, I was thinking, yeah, it's going to be great when he sees some good overtakes. He might even be on for a win. You know, I kind of expected to get a podium at least. But obviously, I didn't think that's Fernando Alonso. He's not just going to move aside. He's going to make his Ferrari as wide as possible. And did just that.
But on the face of it, it wasn't a bad call by McLaren. They split the strategies. They left Jensen on the strategy that was more suited to him, so to look after the tyres and keep them. They put Lewis on the strategy that was more suited to him, which was to have fresh rubber and to push from the back. So I don't think it was that bad a call from McLaren. What Lewis shouldn't have done is, when it didn't turn out right, was sort of whine on the radio that, oh, why did you do this to me? Why aren't they pitting it again? I really thought during last season that he'd grown up and become a bit more of an adult rather than a boy, and he just threw him back to that kind of slightly whiny, slightly petulant version of Lewis Hamilton that we didn't really like very much, which was quite disappointing.
It's interesting, after the race, Lewis's moan was very similar to Barrichello's. The team, they made me lose the race, blah, 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 speech from last year. And funnily enough, look who walked through the shot just as Lewis was giving his interview.
Yeah, quickly out of shot there.
If we move on very quickly, Button was able to win the Australian Grand Prix with partly thanks to the technical failure of Sebastian Vettel, which sent him spinning out of the race. Vettel, of course, would have a better time of it in Malaysia, which would happen this weekend. The Malaysian Grand Prix did produce quite an interesting race. We are best to start off with qualifying, where the wet weather certainly produced a lottery. I think the main talking point from qualifying was the decision of some of the front-running teams in Q1 to wait until the very end of the session to send their cars out, believing that the weather would improve. Unfortunately for them, that wasn't the case. Do you think that the likes of Ferrari and McLaren were foolish to rely on these sophisticated weather systems, whereas the other teams, you know, got out very early and got at least a banker lap in?
obviously, McLaren's excuse was because it's a risk, the same with Ferrari, to send out drivers in a wet track. I think they were just relying on the weather report too much, obviously, and just didn't want to send a car out just for it to end up in the gravel, just like Jensen did. So, you know, I suppose, if in hindsight, yeah, they should have just gone out and just done a banker lap to be safe. But yeah, I guess we're just too worried about the risk of sending a car out on a wet track to only to have it out when it's in the gravel.
McLaren do this too much. There's been quite a few occasions that I can remember where they have sat in the garage while other people went out and they've been caught out by it. If it were the first time McLaren had done it, I would feel slightly less annoyed at it. But they do it over and over and over again and don't seem to learn from their mistakes.
Yeah, Lewis did it in Monza 08, didn't he? Got caught out in Q.
Yeah, that's
the weather.
Yeah.
Ferrari did the same with Massa last year at the same race.
Yeah, they did. I was just going to say, since post Ross Brawn, post the era of Schumacher and his dream team, Ferrari have also been quite open to making these tactical mistakes as well.
They should have just went out. They just had to get a banker in against the likes of Virgin Lotus. I mean, it's just got to get into Q2. It's just as simple as that.
Do you think too much was made about the rain? I mean, obviously, after last year, memories were still strong about the fact that we never got to the end of the race. Again, though, this was a stupid idea of starting the race at a later time when, more often than not, the weather does turn sour. But, as I noticed, in Britain, certainly the build-up to the coverage, the BBC, obviously, as the broadcaster, made such an effort to go on about the rain, and it was going to come. And, obviously, it didn't. So do you think people were too worried about this fact that the weather was going to change? Do you think that the whole of Formula One needs to, you know, stop relying on certain issues such as the rain to try and talk up the show?
I think the reason the rain was bigged up so much because it ended the race last year pretty much. And it wasn't just like a shower, it was a bloody flood. But, you know, obviously I was a bit worried about the rain. I thought, oh God, I don't know the half race. But I was quite happy once Bernie Eccleston said it won't rain on the good walk. I was fine then, because basically whatever he says is obviously going to come true, so.
It happened at Interlagos last year when we were kept waiting for ages for Q3 to start. We had Eddie Jordan banging on saying, this session is not going to restart, over and over again, like a stuck record.
Well, let's look at the race itself, and at the start, Sebastian Vettel made a fantastic getaway to draw alongside his teammate Mark Webber and take the lead into the first corner. Obviously, Mark Webber was the pole man. Do you think that Webber was caught sleeping by this accident, by this move, and do you think he should have done more to try and resist Vettel?
It was a bit, wasn't it? It was, you know, Vettel's come from third, but I suppose Nico was the same. I think Vettel more made a great start because he did Vettel as well, Nico as well. I mean, but Mark did come at him really quite quickly in the first couple of corners, but not that was it.
One man who did make a stunning start from the back of the grid was Lewis Hamilton, who made up a number of places in the opening lap and looked very racy, whereas the other drivers at the back who were tipped to move forward, you have Felipe Massa, Jenson Button, and Fernando Alonso, each failed to move as rapidly as what was predicted. Hamilton was involved in a number of dramatic moments in the race. One that came in for question after the race was the incident with Renault's Vitaly Petrov, where Hamilton appeared to weave on the start-finish straight to try and shake off his toe. Do you think that Renault were right to voice their anger at Hamilton's move down the start-finish straight? Was Hamilton right to do that? Would it have been any different if, say, Michael Schumacher back in his day had done it? There might have been a public uproar.
Well, I think the fact that Petrov was following him on pretty much move for move sort of null and void that. I mean, if Hamilton was weaving in front while Petrov kept the line, then that would be classed as more dangerous, I think.
Yeah.
The fact it wasn't in the braking zone, also it's not a big issue. In the braking zone where it's the most dangerous, they can't really get out of line there. That's the main place I think they should cramp down on, that's for sure.
Do you think this was one of the first successes of the FIA's new system whereby they have an ex-driver in as one of the stewards? Because quite easily, if Johnny Herbert hadn't been in the steward's office on Sunday, you might have found that Hamilton was penalised. Do you think this system of bringing in ex-drivers works for Formula One?
Yeah, I mean, they don't usually use a warning flag at all, do they? I've you know, I can't remember the last time they used it, that's for sure. You know, and I think it was the right thing to do. I mean, it was a bit iffy. You know, I suppose, I think it was how Lewis did it in response to the fact that Petrov was doing a lot of GP2 moves in him, and he didn't like it. So I thought, all right, well, do you want, let's race like GP2 drivers then. And he just did that. I mean, I think if Lewis moved over and broke the toe and that was that, I don't think you'd get any more. I don't think it would have kept moving. And I think the fact that Petrov responded to the way it to what Lewis was doing, like Bud said, then that's why you got, you know, like kind of basically two cars snaking around the start finish straight. But yeah, it was
funny to watch though.
Yeah, it was good. It was entertaining.
It's entertaining, yes. And also maybe it shows the side of the stewards wanting to try and foster as much overtaking as possible, whereby they're maybe slightly more lenient at the moment. Obviously, Formula One has come in for criticism in that department. From one great race to another, Fernando Alonso drove quite a great race, considering that he had developed gearbox issues on the way to the grid during the parade lap and had to drive for most of the race without a clutch. Do you think it was a strong drive from the Spaniard, considering that his lap times are very, very similar, if not fast in certain instances, to his teammate Felipe Massa?
I mean, it's been said that it was the most difficult race of his life. I'd agree with that, but I also say it was probably one of the best races of his life, which seems strange seeing as he didn't even finish it, but it was amazingly impressive what he managed to achieve with that broken car.
That comes on to my second point. Alonso looked very racy at the end, and as he tried to make his move on Button, in an unrelated incident, he suffered an engine failure. Obviously, Ferrari's already had a few problems this year with overheating. And both Sauber drivers, who are also powered by Ferrari, both suffered engine failures in yesterday's race. Do you think there's a crisis at Ferrari at the moment? Do you think there is big concerns over the engines?
Surprised Alonso didn't book himself a flight home halfway through the race when he found out his gearbox wasn't working correctly.
I think with the engines of Ferrari, they've always been a bit iffy. They're certainly not the most reliable engine in the field. And it's probably just very sensitive to heat. But the fact with Alonso, he was stuck behind Massa, then he was stuck behind Button. So he was behind a car in hot conditions. All that's going into those radios is hot exhaust heat. That can't have done any good for the engine. So that's probably why it went. I mean, if they made Felipe move over and let Alonso put those fast laps in clear air, I don't think his engine would have failed. And I don't think
it must be a little bit frustrating for Alonso and for Ferrari, because obviously they see that he is faster. But they need to try and uphold this equal number one status at the moment, because, I mean, if you look after the Malaysian Grand Prix, Massa now leads the championship.
If Alonso's genuinely faster, then he'll get by Massa anyway.
To be a little bit more careful, though. I think that was the reason. I think you've seen it in Australia as well. Alonso obviously did try to make a few moves in Massa, but I think he couldn't be as forceful with the Brazilian as he maybe was with other drivers. You know, obviously he was his teammate. The last thing he wanted to do was try and, you know.
It can't have been easy to get past without a gearbox as well, because you're looking for gears when you're trying to overtake someone. And if you're going into a corner and you can't find a gear, it's going to be a right mission.
Well, we can't go back to the Ferrari days with Schumacher being the number one and his team being made to move over for at the least provocation. Massa is doing well. He is a good driver in a good car. He is leading the championship. There is no way that anybody should be suggesting that Alonso should be let by.
Well, then they should have told Alonso to back off then, because, you know, it was either that or...
Well, that's his choice.
Yeah.
Let's look at the front. It's gone by unmentioned, the fact that Sebastian Vettel was able to take victory with Mark Webber second, rounding off a Red Bull 1-2. We didn't really see much of the front battle, did we? Obviously, Mark Webber had that little problem during his pit stop. Moving on from that, do you think that Red Bull were decisive this weekend? Do you think that they've shown how fast their car really was? And do you think they've got their title chances back on track?
They haven't proved anything. Sorry. They haven't proved anything we didn't know before. We know that the car is fast. We know that it's unreliable. If it doesn't break down, then it wins.
That's an interesting point. I think as well, if the Red Bulls had been pushed a little harder by maybe cars near enough the same pace, I think then the reliability factor might have came back into play. Obviously, during the middle of the race, both drivers were asked to turn down their engines and you know, drive a little bit more conservatively. So, yeah, I think I'd agree with that. I think that's a point. But do you think Sebastian Vettel now looks the man to beat at the moment? Do you think he's going to be able to launch a title challenge and win a few more races and make up for the disappointment of last season?
I don't think so, because I think McLaren and Ferrari will quickly catch up to them, especially in China when allegedly McLaren are going to introduce their ride height system. Once the teams get that same qualifying speed that Red Bull have achieved, then Vettel is not going to be able to get pole, and I don't believe Vettel can overtake for Toffee, so he's going to be stuck behind people, confused at what to do. I mean, he might. He's a fast single lap driver, yeah, but he's not a racing driver. It's just he's a fast lap specialist. Sticking behind other cars, he's not about to do anything about that. That's what's going to lose him the championship. It's going to be between Alonso and Hamilton this year, with Button and Massa in the mix, I think.
Does everybody agree with that?
Oh, I think Red Bull might keep the status quo. It depends on the development race, I suppose. It's a matter of who makes the most gains here and there. And at the moment, I mean, if it stays the way it is, then yeah, Vettel's got a shot. But yeah, like Gareth said, if McLaren and Ferrari and even Mercedes can better their qualifying, then yeah, there might be race on. So,
well, let's look at Mercedes actually, because one man who took the podium was Nico Rosberg. Although he was able to, you know, climb up on at the podium, it was probably the first time we'd seen him in the race after the start, because he rather faded and wasn't able to keep pace with the Red Bulls. Do you think that Rosberg, although he's leading the pursuit at the moment for Mercedes, do you think that he really has what it takes to win races? Do you think he still lacks this edge to be able to challenge for the championship?
Well, I've not seen him overtake anyone on track yet. He's just, just driven. I think that was a bit rubbish then.
I'm not Rosberg's biggest fan. But I do think he's doing a great job in beating seven-time world champion Michael Schumacher. But there are those who say that Rosberg is as good as the Hamiltons and Alonsos and maybe even Vettels of the world. And I don't think he quite is. There is something that he's missing. And he has this enormous confidence, but he's not quite as good as he thinks he is, I don't think.
I was just going to say, I like his haircut.
He makes a good male model, doesn't he?
Yeah. I don't. I'm just trying to check, though, but I don't think Nico Rosberg has really ever improved on his qualifying. I mean, he tends to finish either worse. In fact, he qualified fifth in Bahrain, finished fifth. Qualified fourth in Australia, finished fifth. Qualified second in Malaysia, finished third. So he's going backwards almost in every race. So if you look at all the other drivers, they tend to make improvements, especially the Alonsos and Lewis Hamiltons.
This is one thing Sir Frank Williams was saying the other day, that if he drives well and qualifies well, he then goes backwards. This is one thing that irritated Sir Frank Williams quite a lot. Monaco, where last year especially, he asked Nico, why didn't you drive as hard in the second stint? We could have got on the podium.
It's interesting that, but obviously Rosberg is still, as you said, Juliet, he still has the measure of his illustrious teammate. Let's talk about Michael Schumacher, actually, because we didn't really mention him in the last Grand Prix cast. He's certainly had a number of problems during his F1 return. Obviously, he had to retire yesterday with a loose wheel. But that aside, it hasn't exactly been the dream debut for the German. How do you think he's coping within the Mercedes team?
Well, he's not been out. He's been out of the sport, or out of the car, as long as Luca Badoer, and he's qualifying up there. So he's, you know, it could have been a lot worse. But his head hasn't fallen off, so that's always a good thing.
I think he's still fast enough. I think a few more races you'll see him beating Rosberg consistently.
Yeah, I think so.
He has been unlucky. He was unlucky yesterday.
It will take time to get used to being in the car and then the race, and it'll come back to him, I'm certain of that, that's for sure.
I don't think he's got his consistency. He's kind of there sometimes and not. I mean, if you look at the qualifying for Malaysia, he was quick in the wet there, and I think everyone, I was talking to the time, was like, oh, he's back then. You know, he's found his speed. But then he kind of just faded, and I was a bit confused by this. I thought, God, he was quickest then, you know, in the same conditions. And then, you know, he just faded down. So I think, you know, he's got potential to be there, but I think he's got to find his consistency. that he can, you know, just do a lap of fast laps, rather. He's not consistent yet.
Do you think he's going to be the next Nelson Piquet of 1990, whereby the old hand, the old pro, wins a few races towards the end of the year? Do you think Schumacher might be able to accomplish that? Or do you think that race victories will come sooner?
I think he's definitely capable of doing it. But the problem with Schumacher is he was used to being in a team whose sole focus was getting him a car that could win. And all he had to concentrate on was getting in the car and driving. Now he's got all this other sort of distractions on around him, the pressure, the team, the car, his teammate, all these things he has here that can kind of put him off his game. And I think he hasn't quite got that 100% focus yet. But I think he's capable of winning a few races, and I wouldn't be surprised if he does.
Well, if it's a Schumacher of old, he'll be able to hopefully turn Mercedes around. His work ethic in Formula 1 was, you know, unquestionable. Certainly in the Ferrari years, the way he galvanised that team. So, you know, but you got, to carry on.
Sorry to interrupt there, but I mean, if you compared him to Nelson Piquet there, but I think it's more fair to compare him to Niki Lauda. Because obviously, Lauda stopped racing for 3 years in 79, came back 82, you know, won races quickly, you know, but it wasn't until, 2 years later in 84, 3 years later in 84, where he was on form and he won the championship. So, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It took him a few years to get, you know.
But will he last out the 3 years, Schumacher?
Well, he seems to be enjoying it, so yeah.
Yeah, hopefully.
He's not coming in and looking disappointed. He's got a smile on his face. He's happy. I think he's just happy to race, isn't he? So, yeah.
And it's a positive story for Formula One. So we do wish Michael the best of luck, as long as he doesn't try any dodgy tactics. Hopefully he won't try that. There's no reason to. He's not fighting for the championship. One of the big talking issues in Malaysia, the way from the track, was the teams meeting together to try and discuss ways to improve the show. Has anybody read into this or heard much about this? Obviously, there has been calls for trying to make a few changes for the 2010 season, and also with some breaking news regarding next season's rules. We'll come on to 2011 in a few minutes. But talking about Formula One, it has, as I've said before, and the cast has come under fire in the recent weeks. The teams have often suggested they pointed the finger at Bridgestone. Bridgestone's pointed the finger back at them in terms of the ways you can improve the show. One of the things that seems to be coming out at the moment is the use of mandatory pit stops. Do you think this would really work? Do you think this should really be implemented into Formula One? It seems pretty artificial to me.
Now, should get rid of this mandatory tyre stops rule. Let people make stops if they want to. And if someone says, oh, I can get the tyre to last the whole distance, just go for it.
Yeah, I mean, if that happened yesterday, I reckon Lewis would have won on the podium. I mean, I know a few cars did pull out of his way to pit, but he was second at one point, and I think he easily could have got third. I don't know if the tyres would have lasted the race, but you've got to look at drives. I mean, it did annoy me slightly, the fact that he went on a complete charge from, 20th, and overtook half the field, sat in second place, and I thought, oh, he's going to pit now, he's going to be, you know, right down the field, and sure enough he was. Whereas Massa didn't do anything, apart from sit behind a Toro Rosso. As soon as Toro Rosso pitted, put in a few fast laps, and managed to jump a few places. That is skillful driving, put the fast laps in when you need to. But it's not nearly as exciting as seeing a driver overtake. I mean, surely Lewis must have been sat, you know, after the race thinking, what just happened?
So who's to blame for this? Obviously, you know, we've already hinted at the mandatory tyre stop in place. Obviously, the teams want to try and throw in a second one to try and increase the strategy a little bit more, but they've already got that system in the DTM series in Germany, and it hasn't really improved overtaking. So where does the blame game lie? Is it, you know, one section of Formula 1 should be blamed, or do you think that the teams, the tyre suppliers, the governing body, they all should shoulder a certain percentage of the blame?
I don't think it's tyre suppliers' fault. For a start, I'm just going to go with Max Moser on this.
That's a show.
I really don't like the artificialness of mandatory tyre stops. This is meant to be the pinnacle of motorsport. It should be exciting as it is, not because you have to manufacture some sort of excitement. I think the problem is with the aerodynamics is with the FIA setting rules and allowing people to get around them, like with the double diffusers last year. They need to say, we're going to reduce the downforce and we're going to do it this way. And they need to enforce those rules effectively rather than letting people get around them. And then we might get some overtaking.
It's very hard in a way, though, because the teams, you know, they employ so many people and they use so many aerodynamic, advanced aerodynamic technologies. It's very hard for these teams to either, A, forget how to use them, or B, just simply give them up. Because obviously they have a lot of, you know, external links with other companies around the world for their use and their knowledge. It's going to be very hard to phase out aerodynamics from Formula One. And also you've got this opposite argument about the fact that the aerodynamics are a good thing and that it's a mechanical grip. That's not my opinion, that's the one of Frank Dernie. For all we would love the aerodynamics to be cut down, don't get me wrong, you'd also have to see a radical change of the entire single-seater car system in motorsport. So it's not really a quick fix, is it? But I would agree that, you know, the artificialness of trying to bring in mandatory pit stops, there's even talk about changes to qualifying, bringing in these stupid head-to-head systems which resemble Super League formula, trying to reverse grids and things like that, making drivers and qualifying carry extra fuel weights to try and, you know, introduce a system of success ballast. So, you know, for 2010, if there's going to be any sort of changes, it's going to be something like that. And for me, in my opinion, I'm not sure if anyone else in the cast agrees with me, I don't think they should bother. They should just keep it as it is, because certainly trying to change qualifying, trying to tamper with these things, has the possibility to make Formula One look more of a joke than
it's. Yeah, the thing is, though, it's artificial versus, you know, artificial manufactured excitement versus exciting because that's the way it happens. I mean, if you had no mandatory pit stops, then you would have, I'd expect you'd get excitement because you would get cars trying.
But here we go, this is the whole Formula One again. I mean, this is the business fact. Why is there the one stop? Because Bridgestone need it, and why do they need it? They need it for marketing. It's the same reason as to why they wouldn't make their tyres a little bit more edgy. I'm not saying that they need to or they should be forced to, but they need to try and uphold themselves. We'll move on to what happens in 2011 in terms of tyres, in terms of other things, in just a second. Just one final word on the 2010 championship. Has it really been boring? Would the people in the cast really say it's been boring so far this year? The Bahrain Grand Prix, was it overemphasised?
I think that's if I think that there's a couple of simple but effective changes that would help this. Oh, we can't get rid of the aerodynamics. What can we do? First, eliminate diffusers completely. Just have a flat floor on the car. Secondly, widen the cars back to 1997 specification. That would increase mechanical grip by a lot.
Unfortunately, for 2010, that's not going to happen. Unfortunately,
well, but next year maybe.
Yes. But to go back to my question very briefly before we move on to next year.
Bahrain was boring. Bahrain is always boring. Some of the changes they've brought in this year have exacerbated that, like taking out refueling, which I've always been against. But realistically, you're never going to get a really exciting Bahrain race. And since then, the other races have been pretty good.
Brad,
two out of three. Oh, I was just going to say it's two out of three for exciting races so far. But I don't think China will be, unless it rains. Can everyone rely on raining all the time?
Sprinkle systems at the side of the track.
That's a very good point, isn't it? They can't really introduce sprinkle systems now.
China is the worst F1 track ever built.
Well, I'm sure we'll be previewing the Chinese Grand Prix. Latest weather reports suggest that the temperatures plummeted there, so the cold weather might throw up a few variations and we might, you know, have an exciting race, so shouldn't rule it out too early.
When ice racing.
Let's move on to 2011. One of the other things that was coming out of the meetings over this past weekend was the return of the CARES system. Is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? Should it be a standardised system for all, or should the teams be allowed to develop their own?
I think it should be standardised. If they're going to bring it back in, it's going to cost too much for every team to develop their own. So, it's got to be a standard system, but then it makes it null and void, so... Yeah, I don't think they should bring it back.
Yeah,
I'd agree with you.
Because otherwise, you're going to have the McLaren system, which was the best curse system there, and, you know, you're going to smoke them out the fiery cockpit again, and then, the new teams, they're just going to try and buy the system. The system everyone is going to want to buy is the McLaren system. So, you know, I suppose, you know,
Brad makes an excellent point there. The fact that if it becomes standardised, which more than likely will, because you can't see, you know, Hispania and the likes of that being able to afford to build these sophisticated systems. You know, that if one driver's got cars in the car and they use it, and the other driver uses it, as you say, it does really balance things out.
it might work if it's a strategy thing. I mean, if you can hold your curves back, and like, I mean, it might work with Adrian Suttle, because he was slower than Lewis Hamilton, so he might have opted to use the curves more during just exiting the corners, and Lewis could have held his for the straight and, you know, effed up plus curves.
Do you think they seriously need to discuss how long the driver's allowed to use curves, how powerful each boost is?
I think they should make it not how many times per lap there, but how many times per race. That
similar
way,
A1 GP, yeah.
Yeah, you won't get guys using it every lap and the other guy using it. If they use it at different times, and you'll have a guy that's run out and another guy that's still got two boosts left, and then it might work. But yeah, I think that's the only way.
The problem with that is, in a Hamilton coming through the field kind of situation, it's not going to help, because he'll have used his up overtaking the first six people. He gets to the last six people, he's used his up. They're still sitting there with all of theirs left because they've just been going around in fourth without being bothered.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it helps.
No.
I think, honestly, if you get rid of the double-decker diffusers and have, you know, the underfloors like GP2, you'd get more undertaking like that, because if you look at the GP2 races, there's not a lack of overtaking in them, and there's no issue. I mean, look at Turkey, and Lewis Hamilton, who we know can overtake, spun off, ended up nearly last, and he was able to charge to the field and up third in GP2, you know, so he had no problems overtaking that series. In F1, he can overtake, but it does struggle behind certain cars. So, you know, using that example, then it's the car that's at fault. The only real difference between an F1 car and a GP2 car, apart from, you know, the speed and obviously the more advanced aerodynamics, is the fact that they've got a huge, you know, aerodynamic stuff under the floor, which causes dirty air and stops overtaking.
It's also the braking zones. If they make them larger, then that's more room to make a move then. So I think they should...
Yeah, it made the brakes worse.
The brakes smaller, yeah.
That's a very good point. What about the suggestions that we might have a tyre war next year in Formula 1? Would that interest anybody? Do you think that's going to be a good thing? Obviously, Michelin have said that they want to come back. Yeah, see, I'm a little bit apathetic about the whole tyre war, because we've got this situation where Michelin are wanting to come back, whereas, you know, the Korean companies, Kumu Tyres is one of them, are rumoured to also want to try and bid for Formula 1. So if you have a couple of tyres companies in Formula 1, which of the two names that I've suggested are the teams going to try and opt for? So, you know, it's going to be very hard to try and balance them out. And also, obviously, tyre wars push up costs, don't they? And speeds to dangerous levels, so...
Well, yeah, I mean, the fact is, if you look at the Bridgestones, how good they are now, the last of the whole race, I mean, you pretty much could stick a pair of softs on, or hard, and you'd be okay for the entire race, pretty much, as demonstrated by Button. So, you know, Bridgestone are already there. So Michelin will come back with 18-inch alloy wheels, just so they can, you know, show off the technology to the road cars, which is going to look absolutely ridiculous in an F1 car. You know, and then... It's just gonna look a bit daft, isn't it? And especially when you've got, especially if they've got rid of mandatory stops, you're just gonna have drivers going hell for leather for, you know, 56 laps without stopping, and it's whatever the best tyre wins the race, isn't it, really?
Exactly. I mean, if you believe the rumours, Michelin only want to come back if there's competition. Bridgestone have said they don't want to be in, so you'd end up with Michelin and some sort of lower tyre company who don't make as good tyres as Michelin does. So sort of then you work out sort of which of the teams are going to use which of them. You might end up just exacerbating the performance difference between the top teams and the lower teams, because the lower teams end up with the inferior tyre. I don't know. Competition between tyres kind of worked. It added something extra, but it's...
At the same time, though, you have to remember that when Bridgestone entered the sport, they were in the exact same position as, say, Hankook or Kumu, who are the two tyre companies. As I say, I have to overemphasise the fact that these are only rumour. There is no concrete evidence that they're going to enter Formula 1. But like these two companies, Bridgestone entered Formula 1 in 1997 against the Goodyear monopoly. No one really knew who they were in terms of motor racing. And they started off, obviously, supplying the lower teams. But they proved, certainly in the wet weather tyre in 1997, that they were a professional operation. And they soon brought a lot of teams on board. McLaren in 1998, obviously. And look what happened there. So, you know, I'm not saying that would happen in this case, but can see why the Formula One are looking towards trying to introduce this tyre war, because it may increase the excitement and it may add a new dynamic to the sport. Right, well, it was an interesting discussion today. I'd like to thank everybody on, including our special guest, Brad. Johnny, you haven't really said much today. Is there anything I've missed in the Malaysian race? Anyone like Eddie Jordan or anything like that? Have I missed out?
Yes, Eddie Jordan was a sweat bag this weekend. I think he forgot to pack his deodorant.
Have a wash, Eddie.
I think he'll need to take that shirt to the dry cleaners a few times now.
Yeah, the shirt, to be honest.
It was quite funny that somebody in the BBC production obviously sort of was rifling through. We need to find another shirt for Eddie, and halfway through the programme he came out with a brand new one. I wouldn't have liked to have been the person who had to carry off the old one.
Yeah.
Probably fainted the moment they were handed the shirt.
Poor Eddie Jordan. And for he was even getting attacked by Christian Horner, so you know it seems to be a universal thing that the entire F1 paddock have started picking on him. But
I actually don't blame Horner for that, because I think didn't Eddie interview Horner, so Horner was forced there to smell Eddie's BO for about half an hour, so.
Poor Eddie Jordan. If you ever somehow do come across this podcast, Eddie, and you would like to try and make a
counter-argument,
yes, if you'd like to make a reply to this, please contact us. We'd love you on the Grand Prix cast. But anyways, that's another cast for this edition. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll be back hopefully to preview the next round of the championship in China. So from all of us here, goodbye.